Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, April 28, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to a special teleforum conference call, a Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleforum, and our recap of today's oral argument in the gay marriage cases. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome back to our call to Teleforum Dr. John C. Eastman. He's the Henry Salvador Professor of Law and Community Service at the Chapman University School of Law. He's also the former dean there. He's going to give us some opening remarks, including some background on the case. Some of you might have joined us yesterday for a preview of the oral argument, and we had some background by Professor Jerry Bradley, but bear with us for folks who weren't on the call and aren't necessarily following these cases procedurally. Professor Eastman is going to start with a little background and then get into a discussion of today's oral argument, but as always, we'll be turning to you for your questions. Please do be ready with those questions. And just a quick note that I can already tell this is a popular call. I anticipate we'll have a lot of questions. So when we get to questions, if you could be as concise as possible with those questions, we'd appreciate it. With that, Professor Eastman, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean, very much. And if you don't mind, I'd like to add, I wear a couple of other hats, and they both seem particularly relevant to our topic of our call today. I'm the chairman of the board of the National Organization for Marriage, and I'm also the founding director of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which is counsel of record in two of the 155 briefs that were filed in this case. So the background quickly is, as we know, the Supreme Court 2 years ago struck down a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act. Since that decision in 2013, a number of lower federal courts have used that decision to strike down state marriage laws. I think they've misused that decision, and we'll talk about that as in the terms of the oral argument today. But the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit cases were all up by the Supreme Court last October, and the Supreme Court denied review in all of them, sending the signal to many people that the court believed those decisions were correct. The Sixth Circuit, with a very thorough opinion by Jeff Sutton, then comes out and upholds the marriage laws in Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky and Tennessee, the four states that are covered by the Sixth Circuit's jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court then had a circuit split on its hand, and it took those cases. And it asked the council to address two questions. One, does the 14th Amendment require states to license same-sex marriage relationships as marriages? And then two, assuming the Constitution doesn't require that, are those states nevertheless required to recognize marriages among same-sex couples that are performed in other states where they have become legal? And the court divided the argument this morning, an hour and a half on the first question, and then an hour on the second question. The reason the first one got a little bit extra time is the United States weighed in as an amicus in support of the challengers to the Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee laws in that one. And right out of the box, the lawyer for the petitioners, Mary Bonato, was confronted with Justice Ginsburg saying, Wenzer tells us that we have to give deference to the states. doesn't it say that? Ms. Bonato correctly, I think, pointed out that, yes, the states do have primacy in deciding marriage policy and domestic relations law. But as Justice Kennedy pointed out in Windsor repeatedly, they nevertheless have to comply with the Constitution. So we're back to the question, does the 14th Amendment's requirements of due process and equal protection prohibit the states from defining marriage as between a man and a woman? Now, Chief Justice Roberts, and there's been some speculation that he might be a vote up for grabs here. His first question right out of the box, I think, put that speculation to rest immediately. He came after Ms. Bonato and said, you're not seeking to have new people enter the institution. You're not seeking to join the institution as it exists. You're seeking to redefine it, to change what it is. And that then set up a very powerful, and I think if you're a tea leaf reader, insight into Justice Kennedy, who many people think will really be the dispositive vote here. He says, one of the problems with your whole argument, and I like to focus on specific words, is this word millennia. And he says, you know, there was a time between Brown, when the court decided Brown versus Board of Education and said no to segregation, and then when it decided Loving versus Virginia. And he said there was a similar, about the same amount of time, a dozen years or so, between the time the court decided Bowers versus Hardwick and when it reversed course and decided Lawrence versus Texas. But then he said, here we're talking about millennia. He said, I don't know how to take the time between our decision in Windsor and millennia. I can't calculate out enough decimal points to figure out how much, and you're asking us to overturn millennia. that was rather dramatic. And she kind of ducked and wouldn't answer the question. And so several people came back at the question at her several times in different ways. And finally, Justice Breyer very pointedly said, you've been ducking those questions. You've been giving us, you know, non-answers to those questions. I want an answer to the precise question that you were asked in the briefs and didn't address, that you were asked several times here this morning already. What about millennia? You're asking us to overturn millennia. You're asking nine of us to change something that's been around for a millennia and to change it and mandate it in all 50 states. And he was not impressed with her answer there any more than he had been impressed with her answer the previous couple of times had been asked. Now, Justice Kennedy seemed very troubled by what was being asked here. And as I said, I think he's really the swing vote. Justice Alito came in and says, you know, kept asking questions about what the limiting principle was. If we say the Constitution mandates states to issue licenses to same-sex couples because they express love and commitment to each other, then what about two men and two women who express love and commitment toward each other? What about other sorts of relationships, adult siblings, stepfather and stepdaughter, all these other kind of things? And the answer, I think, again, was fairly feeble. The state would have legitimate policy concerns there that they don't have here. And Justice Alito immediately came back. What do you mean? What's the logic that allows you to draw that distinction? They claim to have very valid public policy arguments here. And it was almost as if the attorney arguing for the plaintiffs or petitioners really hadn't thought to come to grips with the strength of the policy arguments on the other side. When she tried to basically say there is no such thing, social science has all agreed there's no difference for children being raised in one set of circumstances or in another, Justice Kennedy then came back and said, are you basically asking us to ignore all the social science to the contrary? And more significantly, to say that the legislatures aren't allowed to consider that social science either. So it was a pretty powerful line of questions that resulted in that. She came back with, there's no social science. There is a social science consensus that there's going to be no harm. And both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia came back and said, that's not what the record before us shows. There is a dispute, a very significant dispute about what the evidence, the social science evidence. And then they came back and Chief Justice Roberts came back. Isn't the question of who gets to decide that? I thought that was a very encouraging part of the exchange. Now, when we turn to John Bursch, who argued for the states on that first question, he immediately began with pointing out the big issue here is who decides. Now, here Justice Breyer seemed to be playing devil's advocate, as he often does. I think he likes the game of oral argument. He always likes confronting the lawyers at the podium with the hardest questions he can come up with for him. And it's hard to read from his intensity of questions where he comes down on a particular issue. And he was equally intense in opposition to John Bursch for the states as he had been in opposition to the lawyer for the petitioners. But he said, you know, marriage is fundamental. It's open to vast numbers of people, except one group, he says. And so we have to ask why. And, you know, your arguments are people have always done it and religious group thinks it's a sin. Well, neither of those work for me. So what else have you got? And I think John Burson did a fabulous job tying that question back to the threat to the institution that if you remove the institution's nature as rooted in biology, as solving a particular social problem that can flow from that unique biological complementarity of men and women that doesn't exist in all these other kind of relationships we're talking about, that's the reason, and it's a compelling reason, that the states have for protecting that institution. Now, Justice Sotomayor and Ginsburg and Kagan repeatedly tried to say, I don't see how the connection exists, that if we extend marriage to new groups, that'll undermine the state's interest in responsible procreation. They didn't use that phrase, but that was what they were, the argument that they were talking about. And John Birch did, I think, a terrific job coming back around and saying, anytime you're talking about taking an institution that has been child-centric in its nature and saying that that is no longer the purpose. And in fact, that's the only reason states got involved or the governments got involved in the marriage business in the first place. And if you take that out of the equation, yeah, it's not going to happen over, you know, necessarily immediately, but over decades, you're going to have a profound and likely, very likely negative impact from redesigning the institution away from it, what it had always been. And he started down the road of the, you know, the no-fault divorce example that we did. We changed just one of the elements of marriage, the kind of notion that it's a permanent relationship, and made it much easier and flexible to get out of any time you hit a bump in the road. And what have we seen? Well, a dramatic increase in out-of-wedlock births and broken homes and all of the consequences that have flowed from that to society and the harms to the kids. Now, Justice Kennedy, I think, came back with a very powerful counterpoint, and he said, look, your whole argument assumes that same-sex couples don't have the same noble purpose when they're raising children to substitute their interest for their children's interest. And, you know, and John responded, I think, very well, that when you're changing the definition, it has consequences. And we're not talking about just the few children that are being raised by same-sex couples, but we're talking about 73 million children. We're concerned about all of them. And when you weaken the institution of marriage, you harm a significant number of them who will no longer be raised with the benefits of the institution of marriage. Now, Justice Kagan tried to respond to that by pointing out, well, you're going to prevent those benefits of marriage from applying to same-sex couples' children. And he said, no, we're not doing that. We are channeling the institution for the place where most children are raised. I thought he did a very good and deft job in addressing and shifting the conversation to that institutional harm rather than and didn't let anybody kind of stereotypically say, how are we going to harm your marriage if I get to get married as well? He kept coming back to this institutional point, and I thought it was a very effective. I think most people came out of there back where they began, which is a lot of this is going to turn on Justice Kennedy. And the principal legal arguments are we've never applied heightened scrutiny in the sexual orientation context. Whether our cases defining marriage as a fundamental right mean a redefined marriage to encompass same-sex relationships is also fundamental, is something that will have to be addressed in the legal analysis that whoever writes the opinion will write. But what will drive Justice Kennedy is this kind of balance. Are we harming the institution and therefore the millions of kids that are benefited by having that strong marriage institution if we redefine it away from its core biological purpose? And if Justice Kennedy, I think, believes that, and he seemed certainly receptive to the argument, and he seems fully conversant in the briefs that have been filed on that argument, then I think he'll write the constitutional analysis constitutional analysis would write. If he doesn't think there's any harm on the other side, and he's not persuaded that there's even any speculation of risk, then I think he'll write an opinion much like he did in Windsor that focuses more on these claims of dignitary and harms if we don't treat all relationships as if they were marriages. And so I think that's where the crux of the argument comes down. Justice Kennedy on that precise point, of course, didn't give any strong indication one way or another, other than that discussion about millennium. You're asking us nine, us untutored in the social science nine, to weigh in on something here that has been constant across cultures, across time for over a millennia. One took away from those comments that he may not be prepared to do that, even if a lot of people are asking and hoping that he is. So that's the dynamic of the first question. The second question, the lawyer for the petitioners, Douglas Howard Dreimer, kept wanting to re-argue the first question. And the justices kept saying, look, we've assumed for purposes of the second question that the states are allowed to keep a man-woman definition of marriage. So I don't want to hear that they have no interest in protecting that institution of marriage. I want you to focus on, assuming they get to have that definition in their law, do they have a right not to recognize marriages that don't meet that definition that are performed in other states? He seemed to flounder on that question. Finally tried to say, well, if they have an interest in not issuing the marriage in first place because it's in furtherance of their public policy, it's different than saying they also have an interest in stripping away the marriage that somebody had already had. And, that argument, he finally got to it toward the end of his allotted 30 minutes in time, seemed to have some traction with at least some of the justices. But the swing votes on this one, Justice Kennedy in particular, seemed fairly quiet during this portion of the argument. So it was a little hard to read at all where he's coming down. Now, for the lawyer for the states, Joseph Whalen, Justice Scalia came right out of the box and said, I'm so happy to be actually looking at some constitutional text here. And he read the full faith and credit clause to everybody. It says, the states are obligated to give full faith and credit to the acts and judgments, acts, records, and judgments of the other states. Now, Justice Scalia stopped at that point. He did not go on and read the rest of the clause, which says that Congress can decide in what manner and to what effect those judgments of other states have to be given effect in the states. But the conversation then focused on a long-recognized exception to the full faith and credit clause, long recognized by the Supreme Court itself, and it's the same exception that the full faith and credit clause text actually recognizes that Congress can implement as well. To what effect? Other states' judgments. And the court rightly recognized that you got to give effect to another state's judgment to the extent that it bears on their policy. But if it is now going to intrude and force you to change your own policy, you don't have to give full faith and credit to that. Because if we allow that, then one state, like Massachusetts, could define the marriage policy for all 50 states and impose their policy judgment on all the rest of the states, and federalism would be gone. It would be to the most radical denominator immediately. And a number of the justices seemed to recognize that the question turned on how strong the state's public policy was. And then when they said, and we're assuming for purpose of this question, that we've already said the state policy is strong enough to support its right to retain the definition of man-woman marriage. So what is it that would say if we've assumed that, that they can't protect that policy judgment from incursions by other states if we force them to recognize marriages performed in other states? And that's I think, where the question was left there. I think a number of the justices recognize that if the states are not constitutionally prohibited from keeping a man-woman definition of marriage to answer the question about whether they are obligated to recognize marriages from other states that violate that very important policy consideration would essentially be to thwart the state's policy judgment just gradually rather than all at once. And I think there were a number of justices that demonstrated they understood that problem and weren't willing to go there. Whether there's five for that proposition or not, I think, is a very open question. And you didn't get enough in the questions from the other members of the bench to be able to decide that. So that's the report from the front lines, as it were. I'd be happy to open it up for questions now, Dean, if you like.
Yes, thank you very much, Professor. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Professor Eastman, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, but let's go right to our first caller.
Hi, Lurie Callahan. Hi, John. Good to hear your voice. I must admit that I subscribe to the New York Times email service, and one of the comments they made shortly after the argument was over Justice Roberts worried about shutting down a fast-moving societal debate. No, I'm sorry, that's not the one I wanted to ask about. You addressed. So Justice Alito asked whether groups of four people must be allowed to marry. What was the response to that, and to whom did he ask that question?
Well, he asked that to Mary Bonato, the attorney for the petitioners, for the same-sex couples. And all she said was, well, the state would have a legitimate interest in not recognizing that marriage because there'd be concerns about coercion and, you know, upsetting the natural family structures. and Justice Alito came back and said, that's exactly my point. And isn't that exactly the same policy interest that the states are asserting here? So if you've conceded they could not have that understanding of marriage, then why can't they continue to have the understanding of marriage that it's between a man and a woman? And she had no answer. And that's, you know, it was those kind of exchanges that led to that, you know, that pointed question by Justice Breyer. Said, I want you to answer this specific question. You want us to change it for all 50 states. What have you? So the other point I think was particularly important is Justice Alito at one point got her to acknowledge that a state could constitutionally, in question two, that a state could constitutionally refuse to recognize a marriage legally performed in another state if a state had a law that says anybody is eligible to marry upon achieving puberty, so a 12-year-old girl. And the lawyer for the petitioners in that question said yes, they could limit that because the state has a valid interest in not seeing that kind of marriage. We've conceded that the states do have the authority not to recognize other marriages if it violates their fundamental public policy. And then on question two, we had assumed that they had a fundamental public policy in retaining the man-woman definition of marriage because of all the concerns about harms that would flow if we radically redefine the institution. So that line of questions, at least certainly from Justice Alito's position, demonstrated that the states win on both of the questions.
Along that same line, and I'll get off the phone as soon as I said, they also said Justice Scalia asked whether a ruling for same-sex marriage might require some members of the clergy to perform the ceremonies even if they violated their religious teachings. And you see that on some other issues that go from state to state. What was the response to that, and to whom was that asked?
Well, that was asked in the first question, and Justice Scalia pressed that a point. Justice Sotomayor saw the danger in the question and tried to come to Ms. Bonato's rescue there. But Justice Scalia said, look, here's the problem. If you're saying that the states have no valid public interest in protecting the man-woman definition of marriage and that there's a constitutional right for same-sex couples to have their relationship recognized as marriage by the state, then the ministers who are effectively given, deputized by the state to perform civil marriage, would have to marry two men because we have now constitutionalized the issue. Justice Sotomayor said, no, we have same-sex in some states and ministers have not been forced to perform same-sex marriages in those issues. And Justice Scalia said those states have done it by statute or by referendum. We are going to say this is a federal constitutional right, and therefore the implication it was that if you're performing the functions of the state, you would not be able to, quote, discriminate in performing a marriage between a man and a woman and between two men. Now, Justice Scalia pressed that point for a little bit and then moved off of it, and nobody ever came back. But it was, kind of a stark cautionary red flag about the new world that we're coming to if the court mandates same-sex marriage across the country. We've already seen this happen, for example, in Idaho. People have said it will never force ministers to perform marriages or to use their actual church for a marriage service. Well, it was a for-profit wedding chapel in Idaho run by a minister, and he was hauled before the public accommodation because he charged to use the facility and then perform the services. He was told if he could not perform a marriage of a same-sex couple that he was in violation of the public accommodation law. So this was not a crazy hypothetical that Justice Scalia came up with, like some law professors will often do. This was things that are happening right now, and the serious threat to religious liberty that will flow from this rather dramatic and radical redefinition of marriage if it becomes constitutionally imposed because of a judicial interpretation rather than chosen by the people. And this is the real point of Justice Scalia's thing. If we do it through popular referendum and persuasion and the democratic political process, we have the ability to confront all those inconsistencies and other liberty interests and threats to religious liberty and make some accommodation and reasonable exceptions and what have you. If we constitutionalize the question, as you're asking us to do, none of that becomes possible, and it becomes a, you know, it's a sledgehammer that kind of rolls through. That was the concern he was raising, and I think he made an important point. He clearly didn't convince Justice Sotomayor. Justice Ginsburg and Kagan and Breyer didn't weigh in on that issue. The big question is whether this will weigh at all on Justice Kennedy's mind as he's deciding how to vote.
We've got two questions pending now. We'll get to the next question in a second, but before we do that, let me make an announcement about our next scheduled teleforum conference call. Right now, it's scheduled for Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's another Courthouse Steps teleforum. We'll be discussing the Glossop case, argued tomorrow in the Supreme Court. Our call is Thursday at 2 p.m. That's the execution drug cocktail case. Today, of course, Professor John Eastman talking about the gay marriage oral arguments. Let's take another call.
Yes, Michael Chase, a lawyer in Tupelo, Mississippi. My question is, I understand it, am I correct, that at least part of the reason for the Sixth Circuit's decision was that the state's recognition of marriage is really a subsidy, subsidizing that relationship, and that a state has the right to determine what relationships to subsidize based on its judgment as to the relative benefits to the state. Was that part of the respondent's argument or the justice's questions?
Yes, it was, and John Birch made this point directly with in a colloquy with Justice Kagan and another one with Justice Ginsburg, and he said it's the difference between Roe versus Wade and Harris versus McRae. You found a constitutional right to privacy or liberty in the one case, but you said the government did not need to subsidize or provide benefits to the exercise of that right. The same thing is true here and distinguishes the case from Lawrence versus Texas, where you recognize the liberty interest to have the government not interfere with the private sexual and intimate relations of two consenting adults. But now the claim being here is asked for the state to affirmatively put its imprimatur on that relationship and provide all of the benefits that the state has determined to provide to opposite-sex couples because of the unique social issue and concern that opposite-sex couple relationship presents. Now, I don't think Justice Ginsburg or Justice Kagan were persuaded by his answer, but I thought it was a fine answer. And like I say, the real issue is here, did the answer persuade Justice Kennedy? He seemed, in his demeanor on the bench, content with that answer. And it's because Justice Kennedy is the author of Lawrence versus Texas, it's an important distinction to drive home, and I think he did it well.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, plenty of time for additional questions. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Chris Green from Ole Miss. Sorry I missed the beginning of the call, so it's possible you touched on this this issue. But one thing that was striking, right at the beginning of the respondent's argument, I think Breyer and Sotomayor and Kagan and Kennedy were pressing this issue of saying, well, we understand that the rationale for marriage might apply only to heterosexuals and not apply to same-sex partnerships, but is the extension going to actually have a sociological effect, some kind of harm on traditional marriages? It's always struck me that an analogy to trademark dilution would be at least one way to explain that. So there's this old Mishawaka rubber case where Justice Frankfurter talks about the magnetism of symbols changing when you apply symbols to more things. Did that argument get fleshed out at all?
It did, although not in the context of rubbers, I have to say. But no, sorry
Mishawaka
about that.
Mishawaka rubber manufacturing.
I couldn't resist. No, it did, and John Birch, I think, gave a two-part answer that was right on, very, very solidly right on both parts. He said, first of all, under rational basis review, which up to now is what you've been asking me to assume, the fact that the state hasn't extended its benefit system to those that don't advance the reason it provided the benefits in the first place is perfectly appropriate. You don't ask the question, would extending the benefits undermine those who are already getting the benefits? But then he turned, he said, but even if you apply some level of heightened scrutiny, the fact of the matter is we're talking about substantial harm when you redefine the core aspects of the institution. And that's when he then led immediately into the no-fault divorce thing. Justice Sotomayor, I believe it was, tried to shut that comparison down immediately, but he said, look, you know, before we went to no-fault divorce, the number of children born outside of wedlock, with all of the attendant emotional, developmental harms that flow, the much greater increased risk, which is well documented by the Centers for Disease Control and others, all of that, the rate of out-of-wedlock birth went from 10% to over 40%. And Justice Sotomayor tried to minimize that. So say you're not suggesting that gay marriage had anything to do with that. And of course, that was not his point. His point was when you dramatically change the nature and the meaning of the institution, you will almost necessarily have that weakening of the institution's ability to further the purposes that led the state to support the institution in the first place. And he did a very good job articulating what some of those harms would be. That if you shift the focus from the adult loving relationship and with each other, then the first time you hit a bump, you say, well, I'm out of here. It's no longer fulfilling my needs in the way that I wanted to enter institution of marriage. And the kids play second fiddle to that and will necessarily be harmed. And then that's when he came back around very forcefully to this argument. We have to be concerned about all of the kids. There are 73 million of them. Being raised at any given time, we have to be concerned about all of them. And if you weaken marriage, this is your dilution, your patent dilution parallel. If you weaken marriage, you're going to undermine its ability to fulfill that societal function that it's fulfilled so well. And then you circle back to Justice Kennedy's point on millennia. Fulfilled so well, not just recently, not just in modernity, but in every human society across cultures and across time for millennia. And you're asking us to throw that all overboard without any better basis than a couple of recent experiments. So this is, I think this was the kind of turning issue in the case. And I'm really pleased with the way that John Bursch responded to those kind of questions.
Thank you.
Professor Eastman, we've got about six questions for you now, so let's take another call.
Thank you, Professor. If the respondents prevail in both question one and two, what's the path forward with all of the federal rulings that have invalidated traditional state law, constitutional laws?
So there's going to be a legal path, and I think there's going to be a political path that'll be waged. The legal path, what ought to happen is that either on their own via a Rule 65 motion to reopen the cases, the attorney generals in the states whose state laws are currently inoperable because of lower court decisions should file a Rule 65 motion to reopen that in light of the Supreme Court's settling the very same question to the opposite direction, which makes all of those state laws perfectly constitutional. Now, what's going to be really interesting is whether you have some attorney generals who, during the course of the litigation that led to those unconstitutionality rulings, were actually colluding with plaintiffs. I'm thinking here in particular of the attorney general in Oregon. We in a Public Records Act request, obtained 2,800 pages of documents of unbelievable levels of collusion between the attorney general's office and the plaintiff's lawyers, getting concessions that no reasonable lawyer would make, asking them to add additional claims so they could take out more of the statutes, you know, all of these kind of things. And if that attorney general refuses to file a Rule 65 motion to reopen the case and have it decided the opposite direction in line with the Supreme Court's decision, what will happen in those states? I mean, I wouldn't put it past those attorney generals to refuse to do that. And so we'll have a very interesting legal challenge. Does anybody else have the right to raise that issue now that the Supreme Court has settled the underlying merits of the question? So that will be an interesting legal dynamic. From the other side, if the Supreme Court upholds these state marriage laws and then also whether or not they side with the states on the recognition question, I think there's going to be intense political effort from the proponents of redefining marriage to overturn the state laws in those 39 states that continue to recognize man-woman marriage. And so there may be a lot of ballot initiatives. There'll be intense pressure brought on the state legislatures. I think a good number of those states will hold firm. I think some will succumb to the politically correct pressure that's brought to bear on them. It'll be a very interesting dynamic that may well infect the next presidential set of primaries, because this will become the number one domestic policy issue in the country.
If I have a follow, do I have a follow up?
Quickly, please.
Okay. If attorney generals in a particular state refuse to do the Rule 65, Question 65, would the state legislature have standing?
Well, we're fighting that issue out in North Carolina. Our Supreme Court cert petition is pending on that issue right now. The legislature moved to intervene for precisely this reason, and they were granted intervention by the district court, and we expect that that's going to be upheld. In Oregon, we sought to intervene not by the legislature, but by voters and by bakers and by county clerks, and the courts there held that there was no right to intervene. It's kind of a mixed bag. What I think would clearly have standing is a county clerk who was party to the case could easily file a Rule 65 motion. A county clerk who was not party to the case, by rights, is really not bound by the judgment on that case, and they ought to refuse to issue a marriage license. And then when somebody challenges them, they say, look, Supreme Court precedent is now on my side. You lose. The question is whether county clerks, who are also under an intense amount of political pressure by the other side, are going to have the backbone to do such a thing.
Thank you.
All right, let's keep rolling through our questions here.
Yeah, hi, this is Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. Just a quick question. What kind of standard of review were they discussing? Was it the rational basis test? Did they talk about a more heightened standard of review, because it seems to be kind of critical to maybe what the outcome of the case will be? Thanks.
Well, they studiously avoid talking about it in the kind of black letter law form that we would like to see. They treat it as if rational basis review, but they kept talking about the fundamental right to marry and a lot that flowed from that. Did the state have a sufficiently important interest to intrude on that fundamental right? And, of course, that turned on whether there is a fundamental right or not. So they went back and forth on that question. In question two, the lawyers for the same-sex couples argued a Windsor heightened scrutiny, that because states routinely recognize marriages from other states, even when they don't meet the state's own marriage laws, the level of consanguinity, first cousin marriages that are valid allowed in some states and not in others, they routinely recognize those first cousin marriages even when they move across the border to a state that wouldn't have allowed it to occur in that state. And therefore, this is an extraordinary non-recognition of marriages that violates their normal practice, and therefore you ought to give it heightened scrutiny. I don't think at the end of the day that was going to fly, because it was clear when he conceded the point that the state could refuse to recognize a 12-year-old marriage, that there are grounds on which the states would not recognize marriage, so this was not as extraordinary as it might otherwise be, and also that they could refuse to recognize polygamous marriages performed in non-U.S. jurisdictions. So I think that kind of took the wind out of the sail of that argument there for heightened scrutiny. But back on the first one, I think a lot's going to depend on whether we think we're redefining the marriage right, which is fundamental, or we're just simply applying it to a new group of people. And on that question, I think the court's going to be very evenly divided.
We've got five questions pending now. Let's continue.
Hi, John. Andy Yurko in Orange County. I was at the ambush at the Reagan Library a few years ago.
The one where right after Irwin answered that we should have same-sex marriage, there was an earthquake right at ground zero there, and I said, you got to be careful what you do when you mess with Mother Nature.
That's the one, yes. I don't see an end to litigation over this, regardless of the way the Supreme Court resolves the particular issues discussed today. Do you see in that? Where's
well, I don't. So if the Supreme Court if
Congress gets involved.
Yeah, if the Supreme Court upholds these states' laws, you're not only see the political efforts, you're going to see the litigation, the collateral litigation over the judgments that had already gone to final judgment in a number of states, but you're also going to see a lot of collateral litigation as well. Well, if I've married in Massachusetts and I relocate to Texas, and now I've got issues of child custody and hospital visitation, we demand that you recognize that. Even if the court says they don't have to recognize it, they'll say you have to recognize the mother-daughter relationship. So there'll be all of those collateral issues. And this is one of the points that the lawyers for the states made on that question too. It's not just the marriage recognition, but it's the entirety of their domestic relations law that you're talking about upending by forcing into that understanding of the law something that the laws were not written to contemplate. And so the Tennessee, for example, presumes that a child born into a marital relationship is the biological offspring of the two people in the relationship. And what you're going to ask us is that we either have to change our law, which had nothing to do with marriage, but had to do with the child-parent relationship, to change our understanding of parent in order to accommodate something that is clearly a biological impossibility. So all of these things are going to flow, and there's going to be lots of litigation, partly just to bury the courts in chaos to try and force a change. Like I said earlier, to try and force Massachusetts' initial foray into this to set the rule for everybody else. The most aggressive state denominator then becomes the rule around the country. And I think there were at least four justices, I can't predict five one way or the other, that were concerned about that one state driving the policy judgments in all 50, a concern of the full faith and credit aspect of the issue.
All right, let's take another call.
Yes, hello. I was wondering, during the oral arguments, I have two questions. One, did they recognize that the right to marry, I guess I think of it in the other direction. It's not so much the two people right to marry, it's whether the states have the right to intrude on personal relationships because of the children aspect. And secondly, I was wondering on the question of whether or not they should constitutionalize the right of recognition, precisely what clause in the Constitution are they hanging that claim on? So that's all I wanted to hear.
Yeah. So let me take up the second one first. Justice Kagan, I thought, articulated this point well, that it's not so much due process liberty interest, although the liberty interest and the equal protection idea here are intertwined, but that she and the attorneys for the petitioners were relying most on the equal protection idea, and that seemed to be fine with Justice Kagan, Justice Ginsburg as well. On the first question, I think it swirls around why we think the states got involved in the marriage business in the first place. And if there was some societal benefit to be gained by having a third player in every marriage relationship, it's not just husband and wife, it's husband and wife sanctioned by the state to achieve certain state goals. And this came up not so much directly in the way you phrased it in your question, but peripherally in addressing the dignitary claims, in Justice Kennedy's language in Windsor about dignity, of course, the plaintiff's lawyers were using that word as much as they could to try and impress Justice Kennedy. But it came up in light of that. It's just, we don't the state didn't get involved in marriage business in order to recognize the dignity of adult relationships. It really has no interest one way or the other about that. And by not giving you a marriage license, you're not prevented from exercising your loving relationship and whatever it was. So we have to ask why it is that the state got involved in that business in the first place. It was clearly designed around a structure, the institution in which kids are brought to life by the two people that are responsible for that, and to structure it so that there's some permanence and sense of obligation to the best upbringing of those children. And that doesn't exist in these other relationships, and therefore the states don't have the same kind of interest in becoming a party to that relationship in the way that they do in the man-woman marital relationship. And so that's, I think, the tenor of the conversation. The big question is whether Justice Kennedy's convinced enough of the significance of that to overcome the concerns in his mind expressed in Windsor that by not licensing a same-sex couple as married, you're humiliating the children they have brought into that relationship through adoption or what have you. Now, there was no discussion at all about some of the surrogacy, random womb, and sperm donor concerns that were raised in some of the briefs. I think the court shied away from having that part of the conversation. But that's also part of the concern that if the marital relationship is going to continue to be tied to children, and you allow people into the relationship that by definition are not capable of bringing children into the world in that way, then you've got to be confronted with concerns that go beyond that. The surrogacy industry has got to be some concern. The court didn't go there yet, which suggests to me that they recognize they're not just all benefits on that side. There are some harms, and there are potentially vast harms on the heterosexual child side of the equation if we weaken the institution itself. They won't play out immediately, but as we learned in the no-fault divorce context, they played out significantly and dramatically over the span of 40 or 50 years. And we ought not to, if we're going to repeat that disaster, it ought to be one that's done after legislative deliberation and voter deliberation rather than imposed by 9 people on the court.
I'm wondering, Professor Eastman, this is Dean, if that particular argument, if it got down to talking about the children of the traditional marriages, of their dignity, not just harm to them, but of their dignity, and if that particular argument got any traction with Justice Kennedy.
It wasn't raised in those terms. It was just talked about the harm to them by weakening the institution that encourages them to be raised by their biological parents. And that was about as far as the conversation went. Now, the briefing goes a lot further, that some of it is like the gentleman pointed out earlier, the watering down of the trademark, if you will, encourages less people to use that trademark. And then that means more kids are born out of wedlock, and that means more kids do not have the benefit of being raised in the kind of cultural structure that says you place their interests over yours. The first time you hit a rocky road in the marriage, you don't just leave because you've got obligations. And all of those social norms that have been built up, and I'll go back to this word Justice Kennedy repeated several times, millennia. All those social norms that have been built up at millennia further an important social purpose. And if you remove that, you're necessarily going to weaken that effectiveness of that social purpose. I think Justice Kennedy seemed to get that argument. Whether it persuades him at the end of the day or not, I can't quite tell, but at least it was front and center of the discussion today.
We've got about 12 minutes left, 3 questions pending at this point, so let's take another call.
Yes, you seem to be putting a good deal of hope, perhaps a drowning man clutch at straw, into Justice Kennedy's rhetoric about millennia. And you mentioned Justice Breyer, in exasperation perhaps, trying to get a follow-up a response from the petitioners. Did any other justice try to provide an answer to that rhetorical question?
No. They didn't. Let me go back. Justice Kagan and Sotomayor kind of came back, not in direct response to Justice Breyer's question, but kind of in their overall theme, that the states don't have any interest in excluding people from this institution of marriage. And so they kept turning it back, that presumed the negative answer to the state's claim that there was a potential harm in weakening the institution of marriage. And since Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor in particular didn't see any connection between any risk of harm, therefore they didn't see any reason why the state could have a valid argument of not extending marriage to same-sex couples. And so it really did turn on that question of harm. They didn't see it. They weren't even willing to entertain the possibility. Justice Kennedy seemed to be receptive to the argument. And then again, the millennium point was not just it's been around for a long time. The point of his millennial argument is that, you know, every culture has done this and probably done it for a reason. the reason is this thing is so rooted in human nature that's why this has happened. It didn't come out of any animosity toward gays and lesbians that have existed over the millennia. It came because it's uniquely tied to this concern about raising children. And if you change that, you're going to change the institution and create all sorts of chaos and harm. So I think that's where the question centered, no matter how much Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor and to a lesser extent Justice Ginsburg didn't think that question was relevant.
All right, Professor, two more questions left.
Hello, Professor Eastman. This is David Tryon in Cleveland. So as I listen to you report on what the court said, you know, in the media, they've constantly talked about it more of in a context of a social debate of whether or not gay marriage is good or bad. And it almost sounds like it was a social science debate in the court, which to me undermines the very institution of the court. I didn't hear a lot of discussion about the law. And
right.
It seemed there was a comment that you made about federalism concerns these things should be decided in the state. Was that just sort of a passing thing, or was that an important thing? And also, did any of the lawyers or justices express any concern about making this a social debate rather than a constitutional debate?
Well, here's how I think they tied the two together and why so much of the conversation focused on the social science debate. Justice Kennedy's language in Windsor about federalism, about states defining marriage policy, came with the caveat that it says, of course, they have to answer to the federal constitution. And so the question is, are same-sex and opposite-sex couples similarly situated for the Equal Protection Clause to compel states to treat them equally with respect to this institution? And the only way we can answer that question is if we know what the purpose of the institution is. Right, and so that's how that equal protection legal constitutional issue gets tied up in the social debate about what marriage is. The same thing was true on the due process argument. Justice Breyer at one point and Justice Kennedy at one point talked about Glucksberg and the Supreme Court's precedent on how we define a new fundamental right. And, you know, of course, whether this is a new fundamental right governed by that methodology in Glucksberg, or whether it's just an extension to an additional category of people of a long-recognized fundamental right, the fundamental right legal analysis turns on what we understand the institution of marriage to be and what we're being asked to do here. So again, the legal thing necessarily required us to get into a conversation about the social policy of marriage and the social science about the prospective risks and harms on each side of that question. So I don't think they were ducking or ignoring their constitutional obligation. It just seemed it was tied up in some very foundational policy judgments about what the institution's purposes are that required us to have a different kind of conversation than you would normally have in a strict scrutiny three-part test analysis.
Looks like we've got one question remaining, Professor, so let's take our final call of the day.
This is Matt McReynolds of the Pacific Justice Institute. First, Professor Eastman, just let me express appreciation for the many countless things that you've done over the last few years to be a strong and articulate voice on behalf of traditional marriage. My question about the argument today, I listened to the first argument on the first question and was surprised to hear how much of the respondents' argument focused on the interests of the state of Michigan when so many other states are involved and have ramifications from this. I'm wondering if you know whether those other states, particularly in the Sixth Circuit, had an opportunity not just to file an amicus brief, but to contribute to the formulation of today's oral arguments.
Yeah, yes, they did. And he focused on Michigan because he was the lawyer for Michigan. And the way the court structured the argument, even though there were four state cases up there at the same time, and all four states filed their own briefs in the case, making their own what that particular state's interests are, the court directed them to pick one lawyer to argue each of the questions. And so They all settled on John Birch to argue the first question, and so he necessarily focused on Michigan law, but the arguments paralleled the type of arguments the other states made in their briefs as well. And the similar thing happened with question two. The gentleman arguing that was on behalf of Tennessee, so he necessarily focused on Tennessee law, but the points he were making were examples of the very same kind of points that the other states made in their briefs. And thanks for your very nice comments at the beginning of your question. I truly appreciate it. I get hammered a lot on this stuff, so it's nice to have somebody recognize all the work we're doing every once in a while. I appreciate it.
If I could ask a very quick follow-up question, can you tell us anything about Mr. Birch and his background coming into the argument today?
Sure. He was the Solicitor General of Michigan. He's recently left, and he's now with a law firm in Michigan, but had been involved in a number of Supreme Court cases. And if recall correctly, he was a former Supreme Court clerk to Justice Kennedy. I may be confusing him with somebody else, but I think I recall that correctly.
Well, Professor Eastman, we've got another round of questions here. If we can go right up till 3 o'clock, let's see if we can work our way through some more of these.
Sure.
Professor Eastman, John Eisenow with the Foundation for Moral Law. As you know, there have been several dozen states where federal judges have struck down the laws prohibiting.
Could I ask you, if you're on a speaker, to pull up the handset? I'm having trouble hearing your question.
This is John Eidsmo with the Foundation for Moral Law. Professor Eastman, as you know, there are many states that have federal judges striking down their laws that prohibit same-sex marriage. If the Supreme Court in this case were to rule in favor of the Sixth Circuit decision and uphold those laws, how would that affect the laws that have been struck down in other states? Would those decisions automatically be voided, or what would be the result?
Well, they're not automatically voided, but what the attorney generals in those states ought to do, and I fully expect that the attorney generals that vigorously defended their state laws will do this, is to file a Rule 65 motion to reopen the case and have the outcome come out differently based on intervening Supreme Court precedent. More interesting to me is what's going to happen in the states that were perfectly happy to have their laws struck down, whether they would take that step, and if they refuse to, whether anybody else will have the right to do so. And I think that's going to be a very interesting jurisdictional question that may lie ahead.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can get another question in here.
Hi, this is Will Trackman out in Denver, Littler Mendelson. I've seen a few people trying to read some tea leaves. Someone commented that because Justice Kennedy was quiet during question two, that may have indicated that he'd already decided to rule in favor of the petitioners on question one. I know no commentators like to do this, but what are your readings of the tea leaves from oral arguments today?
Yeah, no, I don't think his being quiet. He wasn't entirely quiet. He did ask a question or two on the second half of the argument, but I don't read into his silence there anything about where he's coming down on question one. True, question two becomes irrelevant if question one is decided for the plaintiffs. But I think he is still grappling with the, you know, you really want me to overturn a millennia of human wisdom on this question without looking and waiting to look for the development of social science that is starting to come in now. I think that's what he's grappling with. And whether that means that he will force states to recognize marriages from other states, even if they don't have to license the marriages themselves, I think he's still really grappling with the first question and hasn't fully dealt with the second one yet.
Well, Professor Eastman, let me thank you as well for joining this call. We certainly appreciate you attending oral argument. You've given us quite a bit of your time and energy. I certainly appreciate that. I'd welcome you back for another telephone call when this case is decided. To our audience itself, a reminder about our next scheduled telephone conference call Thursday, 2 p.m., when we'll be talking about the death penalty case. Also a reminder to our audience that, of course, decisions are being handed down by the court daily, so our teleform conference call schedule might well be augmented with other teleforms discussing new decisions. But until our next teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia,
please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.